Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Ross Silverman, Professor of Health Policy and Management and Public Health Law at Indiana University, about an important New England Journal of Medicine article he authored about whether adolescents should be allowed to get vaccines, even if parents disapprove. A really important topic that is so much in the news today, given the epidemic increases in vaccine-preventable diseases like measles that we thought were actually pretty much cured, but we've seen just precipitous rises. First, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters. I want to dive right into our very first one, and it has to do with we have research that's come out that I think has almost every person over the age of 40 probably worried in the United States, and that is about the risks for dementia associated with long-term use of certain medications. This was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine, and they were looking at common drugs such as antipsychotic drugs, bladder spasm drugs, nausea drugs, drugs that cause the lungs to dilate, typical muscle relaxants, and antihistamines and antidepressants, certain drugs within each of these classes. And they were looking at the ones that block a certain chemical called acetylcholine. That's involved in many things like muscle movements, the heart rate, blood vessel functioning, respiratory function, stomach function. And a lot of times when you have these anticholinesterase drugs, that this whole class, the ones that I was talking about, they affect those body functions. So for instance, people get dry mouths after taking Benadryl or an antihistamine, people who get a dry mouth after taking an antidepressant or a muscle relaxant, they may be having these side effects. And they wanted to find out, do these drugs, because they could also make you drowsy in addition to dry mouth, are these systemic side effects, are they related to dementia? And they looked at 285,000 people, 60,000 of who had a diagnosis of dementia. This was in 1,500 general practices in Britain. They looked at up to 11 years before diagnosis and looked at 56 different types of medications. And they controlled for whether or not someone was obese, whether they drank alcohol, smoking, those sorts of things. And they did find a 50% increase in dementia among those who used a strong drug that had this anticholinergic capacity. If they used that strong drug daily for 3 years during that 10-year period, it was stronger for certain antidepressants, certain bladder spasm drugs, antipsychotics, and epilepsy medications. They didn't find it with the other ones, including antihistamines. Others have found different things with antihistamines. So I think this is really important research that suggests moderation is good. Daily use may not be of some of these medications. And yet, this is observation. It is not cause and effect. Bottom line is you really do need to talk with your doctor about the positives and any potential negatives. Certainly, if you had a family history of dementia, you would want to be careful and really see if there are alternative drugs that can be used. Speaking of alternative drugs, our next research that matters is about tuberculosis. Tuberculosis kills over 1.5 million people a year, 500,000 of whom have drug-resistant strains of the disease. There's not a whole lot of research going on traditionally for new tuberculosis drugs, in part because a lot of the people who have tuberculosis are poor in poor countries, maybe prisoners, others, and so the development of the drugs has stalled. But there's a new antibiotic called pretominid, P-R-E-T-O-M-A-N-I-D, by a nonprofit group developed called TB Alliance. Not only is a new drug important because, again, there have been so few new TB drugs that have occurred in the last 40 years, but this drug, combined with two other existing drugs, actually helps with TB resistance. And so, for instance, where TB resistance, only 35% of this three-drug cocktail normally worked, this one could work now in more than 90%. And in addition, this nonprofit company may be a model for making new drugs for diseases that it's hard to make money for in a traditional sense. So that if you look at very few drug companies, they are making new antibiotics because it's hard to make profits by them. So they're not attacking some of the diseases that affect disproportionately poor people in the world. And so this nonprofit alliance may be a way of doing it. I think it's really worth a lot more investment to perhaps have these gains in public health. Our last research concerns something that's near and dear to me and probably most everyone, which is sodas. Do we like diet sodas? Do we like Diet Coke? Do we like Diet Pepsi? Do we like Pepsi? Do we like Coke? Do we like any of the others? You know, I think there's confusion in the general public here. We know that sugary drinks have been really one of the great links to increased caloric intake, really across broad populations. And we know that obesity is such a insidious epidemic around the world in industrial countries. And so the linkage between the sugary soda drinks is really pretty strong. And this research actually in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Internal Medicine looked not only just sugary drinks, but the non-sugary, the diet sodas. And I think we talked about this perhaps in a Research That Matters before, and this is a little bit more deep dive into it, about those who drank two or more glasses of soft drinks per day had a higher risk of mortality than those who consumed less than one glass per month. So two or more glasses of the soft drinks a day. And it was not just the sugary ones. It was also the diet sodas. Again, this is an observational study. These were people that were recruited from European countries from 1992 and 2000. And there's a lot of data that suggests that this is worth looking at in more detail. It's hard to understand the full mechanism of it. Is it the other artificial ingredients in there? It's not the sugar. Are the people who are taking the diet sodas, perhaps they're people who were overweight, they were smokers, they were worried about their health, they switched to the less sugary, hearing those messages, and we don't know that. They try to control for these things, but we don't know. I do think the great emphasis should be on the sugary drinks, the non-sugary diet sodas in moderation. Anything in excess probably has its own sets of problems. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Ross Silverman, professor of health policy and management and public health law at Indiana University, about whether adolescents should be allowed to get vaccines even if parents disapprove. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Ross Silverman, professor of health policy and management and public health law at Indiana University, about whether and when adolescents should be allowed to get vaccines, even if their parents disapprove. Welcome to Your Health, Ross Silverman.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I must say that this is an interesting and maybe controversial topic on lots of levels for lots of parents out there, I would think, about, you know, when can you do things that override the wishes of parents or kind of it seems to go around that or not. So I'm really interested in this conversation today because you come at it from perspectives that I think are really important, which is both public health and legal. These kinds of issues have both public health and legal ramifications. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, vaccinations aren't like typical medical interventions because they're not just a medical treatment or a prevention for that one particular child who's receiving the vaccine, if we're talking, for example, about like the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It's also part of our protective defenses that we put in place in order to create herd immunity within a community to try to prevent the spread of disease. So the way that we in the United States have been most effective in putting these defenses in place has been through law, through the requirements that we've put in place, for entry into things like daycare settings and in schools.
Well, how did you get interested in this intersection between public health and law? It's not every day. You know, we sometimes getting doctors who are interested in public health is like a dime a dozen. But getting and getting doctors who are sometimes interested in law is not too infrequent. But we don't see this intersection, I don't think, as much, at least I haven't, in this intersection between law and public health. How did that come about for you?
It's certainly not as often. We're a growing group that would self-identify as public health lawyers. I think for me, it really came about, I grew up in a medical household. My father was a family doctor himself. But I was not a science guy. I was not a, you know, biology, chemistry kind of a person. I was much more comfortable with letters and systems. And so actually for me, when I got into law school, they had a very small, fairly young dual degree program at that time in law and in public health. And in the way that they looked at public health were, what are the systems? What are the parts of our communities that help individuals to be able to stay healthy or to be healthy? And so that really kind of clicked in my mind, both, you know, the legal issues as well as these kind of systems issues. That's really what got me interested, and that's 25 years ago now. So
how did you get interested in vaccinations? And then we'll begin to fast forward to where we're at in today's environment.
Sure. I certainly, when I got interested in this as an issue almost 20 years ago, I didn't think I'd still be all that active in it. You would think by this time we would just everybody be vaccinated and, you know, we'd be moving on to other issues. But for me, a lot of it arose initially right after September 11th. There was a lot of discussion back then about emergency preparedness and responding to a potential biological attacks and things along those lines. And so one of the big questions then was, what happens if smallpox were to come back? So that got me interested in looking at a number of different legal issues at that time about vaccination purely on a preventive level with a vaccine that had a significant number of potential side effects with a risk of outbreak that was very remote. So from that area, we also were starting to see around that same time rising concern about vaccine side effects because of what's now been a, you know, widely debunked Lancet article that came out in 1998. And so those two issues got me interested in looking at the law and the ethics and how legal structures could be set up in order to maximize protection for public health while also respecting individual rights within reason.
So you really raised up some really interesting issues, which is that balance between overall benefit, overall cost or side effects. And so when you talk about, you know, a disease that like biologic warfare that could affect millions quickly, you might be willing to accept some more risk, but you talk about perceptions perhaps of certain vaccine preventable illnesses where you've got such high vaccination levels that you don't see it much. People's perceptions of what they might be willing to, you know, accept maybe less. So fast forward to an article that you led in the New England Journal of Medicine about vaccination over parental objection. Where does that come into play in how we understand benefits versus risk? Why did this come up?
Sure. It comes up, well, it really came up because of a circumstance with actually one particular teenager, Ethan Lindenberger. And you may have heard a little bit about him through the news. He was a teenager in Ohio who was really interested in getting vaccinated. His mother was very strongly anti-vaccination. And he was like a junior, senior in high school and really wanted to get himself protected, especially seeing all of the different outbreaks we're starting to have. His mother was staunchly against it. And he went to his doctor. He went to the local public health clinic, and kept asking and asking for the chance to make his own decisions about this, and kept getting pushed back. And the response he consistently got was, well, the law says you can't do that. You know, the law says the decision of your parents is what carries the day. He ended up giving congressional testimony about his interest in getting vaccinated. When he turned 18, he got himself vaccinated against hepatitis A and B, the flu, as well as the HPV vaccine. But that was only once he became a quote-unquote adult in the eyes of the law.
Well, I know from my own experience as a family physician and taking care of adolescents that, you know, we were taught there were certain circumstances I didn't need to get parental consent. You know, if the child was, if I had a, you know, a 14-year-old worried about a sexually transmitted disease, I could test and treat. So I kind of known all along that there are exceptions. Why is there an exception for something like a sexually transmitted disease, which public health is a big issue, but not an exception for immunizations, which also is a big issue?
Well, it's a great question. I think the biggest reasons are in most states, and I will have to make a caveat here. Sorry to sound like a lawyer, but I'll have a few parentheticals here. But for the most part, ethics and law kind of line up with parental decision making, in that we basically see that the parents and the child's best interests basically all line up for the most part. But in certain circumstances, especially when we see things that have been in society highly stigmatized, like issues related to sexual health, issues related to reproduction, issues related to mental health and substance use. In those circumstances, we see that sometimes the interest of the child in seeking out care or asking questions or in prevention in those circumstances, their parents may not see eye to eye with them on those things. And so in those circumstances, most states have created laws that would allow the person under the age of 18 or certain people who are under the age of 18 to make those decisions on their own without a parent's interference, because they know the repercussions of not allowing that would be to allow these significant health concerns to continue to go unaddressed.
But immunizations don't necessarily today, in the great majority of states, fall in that category.
That's correct. There are a few states where, for example, if you're talking about hepatitis B vaccine or the human papillomavirus vaccine, those are infections that are transmitted through sexual contact for the most part. So some states have said if someone under the age of 18 is looking to get treatment, testing, or prevention services related to their sexual health, then you can get HPV vaccine or you can get hepatitis B vaccine without parental consent. But without saying that a minor is allowed to get preventive services in that area, most states don't allow adolescents to make their own decisions until they turn age 18.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, let's continue having this conversation. I want to start posing some legal questions to you because I need some answers here. We'll continue talking with Ross Silverman, professor of health policy and management and public health law at Indiana University, about how and when adolescents should be allowed to get vaccines, even if parents disapprove. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Ross Silverman, professor of health policy and management and public health law at Indiana University, about adolescents and vaccinations and when they can get them, even if parents disapprove. And right before the break, Ross, you really gave us, I think, a really interesting, you know, examples about like things like hepatitis B, where they may be able to get tested, treated, even prevention, because it has, you know, sexually transmitted, and that's a carve out for many states, not all, maybe. Yet there would be things like influenza vaccination, maybe, that wouldn't be for sexually transmitted and may not be a carve out. So if a kid said they wanted to get, you know, of influenza vaccination, and their parents said no, they may not be able to get it. Is that right?
That is correct. Right now, the circumstance is for these very narrow sets of treatment issues, like mental health, substance use, sexual health, the law does create a very specific carve-out to allow adolescents to make those medical decisions without the consent of a parent. Obviously, one of these circumstances would be, it'd be great if everybody was on board. It would be better if everybody was on board. But they recognize that these are kind of high-stakes situations where frequently the parents and the child's best interests might be in tension. And so you do have that carve-out available under the law. Ethics and clinical practice would say the best approach is try to get everybody on board as much as possible. You know, that's going to be, from a mental health perspective, from a clinical practice perspective, that's going to be the most supportive structure for the adolescent. But there are these exceptions that are allowed under the law. Most states have not created circumstances where things like the flu, for example, or getting a flu shot, that you can do that without getting the parents' consent as well.
Well, it seems to me that you have low-risk things. A flu shot is low risk for side effects, exceedingly low risk for serious side effects. And yet we know how many people die from flu and more likely to be among people who have not been vaccinated. So I wonder, in circumstances like, we know divorce occurs so frequently in the United States, how often are there cases in which, you know, parents disagree and yet they are co-parenting? What happens?
This has happened from time to time, where one parent believes in, you know, and supports vaccination, another parent does not, and there's a divorce. And so one parent is saying, go ahead and give them, you know, give the child the shots, and the other one is saying, you know, don't you dare. In those cases, for the most part, they tend to side, the court cases tend to side in favor of vaccination. And that's because when you have kind of a split decision along these lines, one of the things that the judge is really going to start to look at is, well, what is in the best interest of the child?
Mm-hmm.
And public health issues, I mean, again, vaccination is highly effective, very safe, it's clinical best practice, and so in many of those cases, it will end up that the judge is going to side with the parent supporting the vaccination.
What happens if something bad happens to a child, and is that child, as they become adult, or could they sue their parent? I don't ever, you know, I never have really thought about that before, but yeah, I'm certain that, you know, there are family lawsuits over lesser things than some adverse consequence. And I guess it could go the other direction, too, if they had potentially an adverse effect from the vaccine. You know, I don't know.
Well, I haven't seen a case like the one that you've described there. You know, and one of the things that I'll say is, you know, anything that I say shouldn't be taken as legal advice.
Yep.
I'm here for education purposes and, you know, maybe a little bit of entertainment, but definitely not to be relied on as legal counsel.
Well, then let me ask you a question in terms of education. What happens when these teens become 18? How many of those who maybe parents didn't vaccinate them, do we know anything about if 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% go on and decide to get vaccinated, or do they tend to do what they've kind of grown up in?
Well, I think I have not seen the longitudinal studies to answer that question, but I can say one of the things that we're starting to see now is, you know, we've had a bump up over the last 15 years in the number of families that are actively declining vaccinations. We've had lower numbers of children in the past that have been covered by vaccines, but that's been more due to access to care issues than it has been about an active choice to avoid vaccination. What we're starting to see, though, I have some colleagues here, for example, at Indiana University, where they are doing, in the beginning of the fall semester, beginning of the spring semester, they're doing vaccination catch-up clinics so that students, as they're enrolling in college, if they may have missed out on certain vaccinations, if they're not up to date on certain vaccinations, to minimize the barriers to them getting access to those vaccines. Now, obviously, you know, 100% of 18-year-olds don't go on to college, but I am starting to see those types of catch-up systems getting put in place to try to get everybody up to date with the recommendations.
Well, I know you talk about in your article, and we're going to put a link to that on our website for our listeners to take a look at. You talk about some states that are looking at, you know, maybe changing the law, and is it 12 or is it 14? I want to say in my particular faith, it's 13. That's the bar mitzvah and the bat mitzvah when the child becomes the adult. We know it doesn't really happen that way, but it does sound like that there's some rationale for that 12 to 14-year-old age.
That's right, and that's where when we look at where most states that have, and we've also looked at what clinicians think about what's in an age where an adolescent would be able to weigh this type of a decision. Really, it comes down to that 12 to 14 age bracket, and so that's what we recommend is that laws, if they're going to be updated, that they be set around that age level. There are some places that are proposing that it be a little more flexible so that it would be physician determination of when the child has appropriate capacity to make a decision. But we felt in writing our article, it's a lot clearer to policymakers, it's a lot clearer to the healthcare providers, to insurance coverage, you know, to all these different systems, and it'd be more evenly applied if you just put a number there as opposed to sort of that more vague decisional capacity age.
Yeah, it sounds like some federal support and guidance would also be okay. Well, I want to thank you. We've been talking with Ross Silverman, professor of health policy and management and public health law at Indiana University. I want to thank you for actually, you know, shining a light on something I think many of us heard about in the media. I don't think we really understood. Certainly, I didn't understand fully. And I think this has implications for lots of issues moving forward about, you know, some autonomy of when adolescents, you know, take control of some of their own health.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. But then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question this afternoon. Understand, Laura, we got a series of questions about pharmacies and medications.
Yeah. And a real theme this week.
Let's see what's on the agenda. What do we got?
Question one. I am a young physician who recently attended a conference about value-based care. I know you've talked about this in the past. I had a patient recently say they wanted to talk to me about 6 different chronic conditions. I knew that I could talk about all of them, but also that it would likely take me about 40 minutes on the phone. I suggested they come into the office, even though it was less convenient for them, but I also value my time and thought I could set limits more easily in the office. Is that a fair request for me to make?
This is such a wild west of what it means to take care of people, I think. And ultimately, it is about taking care of people.
Right.
I don't know, Laura, how you would feel if the doctor said, listen, that's a lot of things for us to talk about over the phone. I would feel better if we could schedule an appointment. Is that a fair thing to ask?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's an unreasonable request.
Yeah, and I do understand, you know, limit setting. I think one can set a limit setting on the phone. You know, if I call someone up on the phone and they say, let me ask you a couple of other questions.
Yeah.
You know, I call up to give them some lab results, for instance. It's not uncommon to say, I got a couple other questions. I'll say, you know, I can take one or two.
Yeah.
You know, I've already set a limit. You know, I can take one or two. Or that's a really good question. But, you know, that question alone is actually probably going to take about 15 minutes to talk about fully. I can give you the short answer. But
yeah.
If you want the longer answer, maybe we can wait till the next time you come in. So
right.
Part of it is determined, is there anything acute going on? Is there anything that really has to be answered time-sensitively? Now, six questions would suggest there's a lot to talk about.
Right.
It's not a short conversation.
No.
And I don't think it's a whole lot different if it's happening in the office or if it's happening in the home, if it's happening on the phone. Sometimes on the phone, you know, it may be harder to hear. It may be harder, you know, we may not have the equipment
yeah.
to do the telehealth to actually visually see their cues, you know, and so it may actually take a little bit longer. So I think the request is a reasonable one. But increasingly, we should be doing work that is convenient for you.
Right.
That does take care of what you want. Maybe we can take care of two of them right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe we'll talk again in a week and take care of two more.
Yeah. Schedule something for another week away
yeah.
or, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. We have to get more familiar, more comfortable, and offer more options for people. That's where we should be heading. What's our very next house call?
I recently saw my doctor, and they sent in refills of all my medications. Six of them total for high blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis, and acid reflux. I looked online and saw another pharmacy nearby where the medicines were all cheaper, and I sent a message to my doctor asking if they could resend them to the new pharmacy and cancel the other prescriptions. I felt like the office gave me a little bit of a hard time about it, but it will save me money. It seems like a pretty simple thing to do, so I'm curious, why would they have balked?
Well, you know, I don't think I can defend that in any form or fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand it, though. You know, it's like, you know, empathy to the doctor. We also want to be empathetic to the system here when
yeah.
need be, and also empathetic to the patient, most importantly here. I think this happens so often that patients move around to different pharmacies. You know,
yeah.
they move to different cities. They find one that's cheaper. They find the copay that changes because
right.
these pharmacies have different arrangements with different drug companies, different chains, different incentives. It's impossible for the doctors to keep up with this information.
Right.
Really impossible. And so the doctor's going to assume, probably falsely at sometimes, that the pharmacy you have listed in your medical record as a preferred pharmacy is the one that you should send the prescriptions
right.
to. And it takes, you know, to get a prescription renewed even, you have to say, are you still taking it? Are you still knowing which one it is?
Right.
Are you still taking it? How are you taking it? Going through all the things. Do you want to have 1 month of prescriptions, 3 months of prescriptions? The dose, is it once a day, twice a day, three? You have to, you know, all of these things. So to put a refill in can take 1 or 2 minutes per prescription. That wouldn't be totally unheard of. And to then go in and change that for six prescriptions may take 10 minutes. It would
yeah.
not be unusual. And then to wanting to cancel to let the other pharmacy know that you're no longer using it, you may need a phone call because you don't want to get two different ones. Maybe
right.
your insurance company won't fill them out. What seems simple, it's become a little more complex, right?
Right.
Right. And so I'm so thrilled that you're going to be able to save money.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly would want to do that. The problem sometimes is, well, maybe you were out of your prescriptions and you needed them yesterday. And the doctor called in and did what they needed to do. And then a day later, you want it changed and moved. And the doctor now may have, or the health system or the care may have, five or six other things that are happening simultaneously. And they may not be able to get to it in the 6 hours, 8 hours. It could be 24 mm-hmm. hours. So everyone needs to understand that we don't have a perfect healthcare system.
Right.
And I think people really are trying to do their best. And I say that the doctor's office really would want to help you get cheaper medicines.
Right, sure.
Absolutely no reason why they wouldn't want to do that. But it might take another 6 or 12 hours. It may not happen in that first, you know, period of time.
Right.
What's our next house call?
Our next house call is, when I go see my doctor, they almost always send prescriptions electronically to the pharmacy. Yet half the time, it seems like the pharmacist says they don't have it. Now, I've tried to ask the doctor to give me a printed prescription in addition to sending it over electronically, but they say they can't do both. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons why that may be. At times, it may be okay. I mean, you may assume that the insurance company isn't going to fill two different ones. You also wouldn't assume that a patient would want to get two different ones filled.
Right.
For certain controlled substances like benzodiazepines, the Ativan, the clonazepam, the Valium type drugs, well, you can't do both because you have a risk of diversion, a risk of two-fold. So legally, you couldn't do both. And so knowing which one, of course, if you send it electronically and the patient says they want it printed, you now have the situation that you almost had in our last house call. So you have to cancel the other one. That may take a phone call to make certain and then do it. So that's now all of a sudden that it's going to be, if you have to call up and you have to actually reach the pharmacist on the phone to cancel it, that could take you minutes, 5-6 minutes. It would not be unusual. I get what wanting to do that. I would say there's going to be a little inconvenience if they're printed out. You may have to take them and you may have to wait and go back to your pharmacy. So I'm usually willing to do one or the other. Sometimes I get two of the medicines are printed, four different other ones are sent in electronically because maybe they can get those two ones cheaper for some other reason. That's perfectly reasonable. Let's get these defined as close as we can up front to try to get it right the first time. Great question. What's our very last house call?
I recently went to see my doctor with concerns about migraine headaches. I had tried ibuprofen, but it didn't work and actually made me nauseous. I can't take some of the common medicines because of blood pressure problems. She suggested a medicine called Fiorasset, but when I went to the pharmacy, it was almost $80. I called back and said it was too expensive, and the doctor asked me to talk with a social worker who ultimately said there was a coupon available that would allow me to get that medicine for $18. Why didn't the doctor just tell me this in the first place?
Probably the doctor didn't know about it.
Yeah, right?
I mean, I think if the doctor knew that you could get it for $18, here's the problem. Just like we've been talking about, there's so many variations on a theme. There's so many different medications. And to know who's discounting it, is it the discount by the company that makes the drug? Is the discount by the third-party administrator who administers the drug? Is the discount by the drug company? Is the discount by the pharmacist, pharmacy chain? It could be any and all of the above.
Right.
Doctors, there's no way they could keep up with that in the real time in the doctor's office, with the exception of increasingly there are other people, pharmacists and social workers in the primary care medical center home who are able to. And so increasingly, my guess is that patients, you'll have a say, you know, if any of these medicines are beyond what your co-pays are, if they're beyond, because sometimes you may go in and that same drug may be $5. You're only paying $5 out of pocket.
Yeah.
In this particular case, the patient's insurance plan may be dictated that they had $80. Really hard to know. Is the medication on a generic list or not? Complicated, isn't it?
On all ends.
It's a lot of work on all ends. And I think being patient, working on using all the resources we have at our disposal to help the patient get the right drug, the right time, the right place, and at the right cost.
My pharmacist actually once recommended GoodRx. It's an app you can download and enter in your medication, and it will also sometimes alert you to certain coupons too. So that can be a nice tool to use.
Yeah, and in this particular case, that medicine should be a generic medication because it's been out for a long time. It's an oldie but goodie that has a little bit of kind of pain relieving things, has a little bit of kind of scheduled drug. You can't just easily get it. But I'm surprised it was that expensive. Sometimes generics can be really expensive, too.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for really important issues today about medications. Anyone can send us their own questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Ross Silverman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.